Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's November 14th, Thursday, and Franklin Sanders is back to join us for the Precious Metals Market Report. Franklin needs no introduction, so we'll just dive in. I'm out in California. Franklin's back in Tennessee, where I will be by Thanksgiving. So, Franklin, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, the market has been phenomenally interesting for the last 2 months since we talked to you last, so why don't you bring us up on it?
I haven't really been that interested in it.
Really? Now, every day I read your commentary. And
oh, it's painful. It's painful because, you know, I've gone through this before, and it just every day just kind of, you get one day that raises your hopes and 2 days that dash it. And that's the way long corrections go, you know, and it's just real painful. If you look at that, I guess we'll start with a short-term gold chart if you've got that up.
Yeah, there. And I should mention for the subscribers, all of the charts are under subscriber resource at your blog post.
Okay. But the gold chart, the short-term gold chart, and when I say short-term, I'm talking about since April, has traced out what I interpret as an upside-down head and shoulders. If I'm wrong, I'll go into what that means. But from where you see that right there, gold is at an uptrend line from the June low, about 1180, and that same uptrend line was verified again in October, and it's come down in the last couple of days and hit that again. And so this is really one of those places where you have to fish or cut bait. The red line, the green dashed line is that uptrend line. The red line that sort of slants over to the downward just a little bit is the top of the shoulders, if that is an upside down head and shoulders formation. It clearly, if it breaks that line, it ain't. The seasonal pattern is for gold to make lows in November. There's about a two out of the last 14 years, two yearly lows have come in November. No lows ever occur in December. And one of the things that keeps me from relying on that is that markets always surprise you. So just about the time you think you've got it scoped out, they do something surprising. There are a lot of lows in January. So we're looking at one of two things. I mean, I operate right now on the presupposition that the June low was the correction low, and we won't see prices any lower than that. If that's so, then we're going to get a rally from here over 1362, which is the last high, and then over 1434. It can't break through this 1260 line. If it does, well, I mean, maybe 1225. But if it breaks through that 1225, then you have to assume it will go probably lower than it did at that 1180 back in June. The silver chart looks a lot the same way. You've got, you know, silver dancing around on that uptrend line from the June low, but also hitting on that shoulder line of the upside down head and shoulders. So, you know, you're just at a fish or cut bait point. You're either going to.
So, Franklin, how low, if assuming we're still in a primary trend up, how low could it go to still be in a primary trend up before you break through and you say, okay, no, this is not a consolidation, this is a bear market? What's that line?
I've got a monthly trend. I've got a monthly chart up there. If you get that monthly chart in front of you, you'll see that the uptrend line on that monthly chart, which would be just a little bit different than a daily chart, shows that that 1180 low, 1179.40 low, did not reach all the way to the uptrend line. And I would have to see, you know, a 3% violation of that line to say, well, maybe that's it. Maybe, you know, it's all over. Well, if it violated that 1180 low by more than 3%, I'd say, yeah, that'd be pretty bad, but that would take it to 0.97 times 1180.
1144.
Yeah. But I was doing some other calculations today that said it could go to 1075 or so. So that, those things would make me think, but one of the reasons I don't think that the bull market is over is that it hasn't been fulfilled in either price or time. In price, you've seen a 753% rise from the lows, but in the last bull market, you saw a 2,300% rise. So that's not anywhere near. And now, there's no hard and fast rule on that. I mean, a bull market might double or it might go up 50 times. So there's no hard and fast rule, but, you know, you compare to the past and you say, well, it doesn't look like that's enough. Also, if you look internally at the development, the unfolding of this market, it doesn't look anything like it's been completed, and you don't have that parabolic blow-off that you saw, say, from September of 1979 to January of 1980. And you always get that parabolic blow-off, and you just haven't seen that. What we saw in 2011 was not a parabolic blow-off. Silver, the time element is not long enough either. It's only been 12 years, and that ought to be probably 15 to 20. Then the silver, and there's a monthly chart, the silver of silver too, and you see the same phenomenon there, that it hasn't really reached that long-term, very long-term uptrend line. You know, silver can go to $17.50, could go to $15, but it's only gone up 12 times, 1,200% from its beginning low, and last time it went up 38 times from its beginning low. So those things tell me, no, it hasn't happened. Those are technical things they tell me, no, the bull market is not over. Those are technical things. If I look at fundamental things and I ask the question, how is it, what has changed? What fundamental driving forces of a gold and silver bull market have changed? The answer is nothing has changed. The answer is that it's monetary demand that drives a gold and silver bull market. I hope everybody understands that. It's not physical demand. You know, it's not because everybody in India decides they want to wear more earrings or something like that drives a gold and silver bull market. It's people who get scared about the stability and solidity of the currency. That's what drives a gold and silver bull market. And right now, you're going through a period, not surprisingly, a period of correction, where people are just numbed, and the new money that the Fed has created has gone into the stock market and created it flows into some kind of assets first. It's gone into the stock market, created a boom there. And so people say, well, why do I need protection from gold and silver? Well, I think if you look back, you know, I've said already, if you look at the period from 1975 through most of 1976, you see the same kind of correction, actually not as vicious. The correction from 1976, beginning 75 to August of 76 was about 52%. So gold lost 52% of its value in that time, and still came back it still increased about 8.5 times from that level. So the latter, you often get one of these big corrections in the middle of a bull market, and invariably the latter rise, the latter rally, the latter half of the market, if you will, is always way, way greater and way outperforms the first part of the rise. And I put all that together and I say, no, this is not... The bull market is not ended yet. You know, this has really been painful, but it hasn't ended yet. But, you know, you can look at other markets. You can look at the Dow in 1987 when there was a, you know, horrible, like 44, 45% drop in a few days. And then you know, I mean, if I want to get more esoteric, then I look at what happened to the market in April, and I look at the way that it's traded since, and I say, well, somebody's interfering with the price. And I don't have any doubt that the gold market is being central banks are hitting the gold market. It's interesting that this week, I think I sent you a link to the article on Zero Hedge about the confidential 1974 memo to Paul Volcker from a fellow named Sidney Weintraub about how it was necessary to control the gold price. It was necessary for the dollar to control the gold price. Well, if you know the history of that period, no sooner was gold ownership legalized in 1975 than they began to hold U.S. government auctions to sell off U.S. gold reserves. And when they weren't, when the federal government, the Treasury, wasn't doing it, the IMF was doing it. And, you know, in between times, they'd float all of these rumors and noises about how they were going to sell off all the gold, and my goodness, you know, gold would be worth less than dirt and all this other stuff. You know, that constant barrage of propaganda was kept up. So if I look at these two time periods, I'd say, well, you know, there's probably somebody there who was working, probably still somebody in Treasury who was working there in the 1970s, and they remembered how to do this. To me, you've got to factor that in as part of what's going on. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, I don't want to ever fall back on that as my sole.
Right.
If you fall back on that as your sole reasoning, then you've created a deus ex machina, you know, a god out of the machine that always explains everything. Well, life is not that simple. The world is not that simple, I don't think. But I do think that's one of the things that we're seeing.
Well, you have market fundamentals, and then you have politics, and then you have expectations of which is going to win. So, you know, and all of those are playing together. But I, you know, to me, I think you clearly had, you know, I've always believed much more than you that if you look at the military and intelligence systems available to support the dollar, that the dollar has much more strength than I think many people in the financial community believe, or at least the ones we, you know, sort of we read and talk to. And that's the...
Yeah, let me just point out what you're saying.
Right.
Okay? You're saying that the U.S. government operates the same way that the mafia does internationally. Am I correct? Is that an overstatement?
Well, I would say the U.S. government operates like an empire, and it's no different than if you go back through history and you look at who managed the reserve currencies, they all control the sea lanes. And, you know, he who controls the sea lanes can control, you know, the trade and therefore can control the reserve currency. And the reserve currency, on one hand, can tax globally, because, you know, essentially it's debasing through the balance sheet, and that's kind of an invisible tax. But then it also has the expenses of running that system and, you know, providing that global enforcement or the enforcement within the region it operates. And the question is always, you know, sometime, at some point the military expenses and the corruption bust the bank and overwhelm the ability to tax. So, yeah, I think the system runs by force. And it's not force alone, but certainly over the last 20 years, it's become more and more force. And I think, you know, the decision in the 90s was they said we can downsize or we can, you know, go global and become a global empire. And if you look at where the military has been allayed ever since, that's to me what it looks like. But I do think, you know, oftentimes, this is not my conversations with you, Franklin, but oftentimes with various financial folks, they'll say the dollar's going to crash, and I say no, it's not. And I think the difference at that juncture, and the reason it doesn't, is in military and intelligence and political. You know, at the G7 level, things are highly managed. So
I don't doubt that. You know, at the G7 central bank level, things are highly managed. I mean, why do the heads of those central banks get together once a once a month for supper in Basel. Why did they do that? At the Bank for International Settlements. They, or either the heads of those central banks or their representatives, why do they get
together? Right, because they have to coordinate. They have to build consensus.
Right. Well, they're not there to taste the wine. I mean, you know, that's too far to go for a wine tasting. So anyway, where you and I disagree is I believe that there is a massive amount of power. There is certainly an elite that controls massive amounts of financial power that benefits from this, that acts as a parasite on all of the rest of us, and that looks upon you and me as expendable as a farmer looks on chickens. Not even as good as milk cows. I mean, I will concede all that to you. I just think that they operate more by bluff than by power. Now, once you get overseas, once you get out of markets, you're certainly right. You know, if you get too far out of line, you might find your country invaded.
Here's the thing. Yeah, if we look at all the steps that have taken globally, that governments have done to discourage the purchasing of gold, whether it's what happened in Cyprus and Cyprus suddenly having to sell its gold, or we had one questioner asking about Stuart Thompson's coverage of what's been going on to discourage Indian purchasing or make it difficult for Indian, you know, gold companies to transact globally, on and on and on. I mean, we are watching a remarkable number of actions by governments around the world to make gold buying difficult.
Yeah, well, but fortunately, the Indians are completely lawless.
I mean, God love them.
You know, I mean, if you know about the history of, you know, I mean, Dubai, for instance, has a huge amount of gold, little bitty place, and they have this huge traffic in gold. Well, where's that going? And silver, by the way. It's going into India. They smuggle it into India. That's what's happening. So when the Indian government does that, it means that they're going to make gold more expensive and more profitable for gold smugglers, more expensive for native Indians, and more profitable for gold smugglers. So how much will that cut down the imports? Well, it'll cut down the official numbers quite a bit, but the unofficial numbers, it won't affect that strongly. It means there'll be more smugglers going into business. So yeah. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much that means. It's like the argument about people arguing for gold going up because the Chinese are buying more. Well, yeah, the Chinese are buying more, but somebody's selling more. So that's just a flow from one place to the other. That's not necessarily an increase in demand. So I'm not sure how much that means. I hear a lot of things in the gold and silver community that are kind of accepted as gospel, like that Chinese demand increase. And if you look at them a little closer, or you look at them from another direction, they sort of evaporate as important items. So anyway, I mean,
it's funny. You know me. I drive a lot. When I drove out to California about 2 months ago, everywhere I went, the pawn shops were trying to buy. You know, that you had signs out, we're buying, you know, it was a giant sucking sound. So I'm driving back starting this Friday, and I'm curious to see what the pawn shops look like. If the giant sucking sound is stopped, then I know, you know, it's different. But certainly in the economy, there's a tremendous amount of deflation. And I know certainly in the U.S., despite all the buying that the Fed has been doing, that money is not leaking out on Main Street. It's quite phenomenal. The banks from everything I've seen are under tremendous pressure not to lend, but rather to buy treasury securities or to do things that would eventually put it in the stock market. So, you know, it's kind of like a hydraulic pumping system the money's not leaking. And the other thing I see is that the news, whether it's the NSA scandals or Obamacare, has got every business person wanting to pull in their horns and be careful. I mean, to me, central control is the most deflationary thing you can possibly do. You know, everybody just stops wanting to take risk.
Well, yeah, there's a presupposition behind what you're saying, and maybe we ought to state that for your listeners. And that presupposition is that all our money is borrowed into circulation. And when I say presupposition, I mean you understand that, and you're basing that statement on that. And so if the borrowing stops, the money supply stops growing, and there's an inherent deflationary tendency in the money supply because all the money that's borrowed into existence comes into existence with an interest rate burden on it. And
right.
once those dollars go back to the bank to pay for that interest rate, they don't, you know, there's a deflationary tendency there. So you had the Fed engineering the booms of the 90s and then the booms of the 2000 to 2008 period. And afterwards, there should be a big cleansing, and that's what the deflationary or depressionary period would be, a big cleansing when all that bad debt is written off and all of those economic projects, all those projects that were undertaken in the economy that really shouldn't have been undertaken and wouldn't have been unless there was a false monetary signal, all of those should be liquidated, but they're not. And so consequently, you've got what you call deflationary tendencies. I don't want to call it that because deflation is a decrease in the money supply. And the true money supply, if you look at TMS, which the Mises Institute does, the true money supply is still increasing. But the banks, the Fed is keeping that money from going out into the economy because
right.
they're paying the banks reserve. They're paying the banks interest on their reserves. Well, if they're paying the bank, I don't know what they're paying, but if they're paying them 0.25%, and it's virtually, it is risk-free.
It's free money.
Yeah, it's free money. I mean, what? See, so the whole of QE3, QE1, 2, 3, the whole deal was aimed at reliquefying the banks, making the banks whole.
Well, but I also think it was, you know, in the process, they're taking mortgage securities that were fraudulent, that were essentially worth nothing, taking the files in and then shredding them.
It's the garbage can deal. It's
right.
the same old garbage can deal. When we blow up a bubble, and all of a sudden we've got all of this garbage that we got to do something with, we create a garbage can where we can hide it all. Before, it was the Resolution Trust Corporation in the 1990s. Today, they've made the Federal Reserve the garbage can, and they've buried all that bad paper.
Well, it's funny. When I used to have a deputy at HUD who used to say that FHA was where mortgages went to die. And they literally, from what I can tell, have essentially wiped out FHA's reserves, stuffing bad mortgages
yeah.
into FHA. But this time around, it was so big. You know, last time it was too big for FHA, so they did the RTC. This time it was too big to even do a bad bank. And, of course, they had real problems because they had to shred stuff, and so the bad bank wouldn't work, and so they used the Fed. But, you know, I think that's... But I would have expected that to be done, and they could start tapering, but, you know, that hasn't happened. Some of the charts you sent us that are up at the subscriber resource are on the federal debt. And one of the things I wanted to point out, because I think it's very important to look at the federal debt, because between the QE from the Fed and the money that the federal budget is pumping into the economy, you know, it's basically... You know, we basically have had a federal takeover of the entire economy. But if you look at the deficits this year, they were much lower than expected. And so if you look at the cuts, the pain is much less than was predicted. If you look at 2014, that's not going to apply. And so I have been amazed, Franklin, at the extent of the anger that is occurring in the general population as a result of Obamacare and the NSA scandals. And when you realize that that's hit at a time when the cutbacks really aren't rolling through that are coming, you know, so to me, 2014 is going to be a very interesting year because now you have a general population that's saying, you know, this is nuts. These people are, you know, there's an alienation that have put people across the Rubicon, so to speak. And then the cuts are going to start to roll out 2014. Whatever cuts they've seen this year are nothing compared to what next year might bring. So that to me says, you know, if one of the things that impacts gold and silver's value is people's faith in the system, I think the system is a lot more comfortable this year than it's going to be next year.
Well, I don't doubt that's so, and I was thinking about it today and talking to two friends about it, and one of them said, well, how can the Fed create all of this money? Now, this is the same question you and I talk about over and over. How can the Fed create all of this new money and there be no rise in prices, no apparent inflation? Well, I mean, laying aside for the moment that they jimmy the figures, I think part of the reason that people are not more frightened than they are is that they're numb. They're just numb. It's been, you know, there's been a crisis going on here since 2006, really. You know, that's when the mortgage industry started coming apart. So
I thought it started in 1996, but apparently a lot of people didn't notice.
Well, I mean, it's been going up, but it's been headline material, and they've applied the, it's not peculiar to the European Union, but it's, they did it very skillfully in 2011. And that is just talk the crisis to death. Just talk it to death until people finally say, I just don't want to hear about that. Debt ceiling, the first time it came up, everybody thought, oh my gosh, the U.S. will lose its credit rating, yak, yak, yak. Well, the credit rating was downgraded, and then the debt ceiling thing has gone, I don't know how many, we've had three rounds of that. We're getting ready to face another one in January. And the public attention span is about 4 seconds. That's just about it. And once they see that stuff, they don't even give it 4 seconds. You know, that they've heard it so many times, they just pass right on it, over it. So I think one part is the public is numbed. We got into a longer conversation today about whether or not the public has been so docilized and trained by public education, always called the experts and always to depend on the experts. And that's, you hear the heavy quotation marks around experts in my voice. People just, you know, they think, well, I'll just keep hanging in there with the Federal Reserve and the federal government. They'll get, you know, things will get better. What you're saying is that they're being delegitimated. That the allegiance that the common man gives to the Federal Reserve and the federal government is dissipating. And if that's so, they got a big problem.
I think it is dissipating. You know, it's a little symptom, but I put it up on the blog this week. There was a funny chart of the data on how many applications the National Instant Criminal Background Check System website processed, which was, you know, about 1.5 million, compared to Obamacare, which was a little bit less than 50,000. So 34 times more Americans interested in buying guns than buying Obamacare. So I think that's a pretty, you know, here's the thing. I find it very hard to get honest feedback because people are very careful. They're very nervous about, you know, they're smart. They know not to trust the system, but you see a little statistic like that. And of course, all the statistics on gun buying continually indicate that, you know, that there's a lot of appreciation for the real problems here. So, well, I did want to go into a couple things about sort of that impact the long-term trend in addition, because as you know, I continue to believe that the chances that the primary trend will reassert are greater than not, but I do see scenarios where it could not. One is, and of course this is me, I believe the ability of the G20 to implement and maintain policies that kind of, you know, husband the gold for the central banks. I think the central banks really, the pressure is on to settle those accounts. And, you know, you've got Germany, you've got Finland, you've got other countries being pressured to, you know, get their gold back. And so I really do think there is a giant sucking sound. I remember during the April slam down, I told this story before, you know, I had a broker who promotes precious metals basically call me and say, okay, any account with more than 20% precious metals, we want out in a week. FINRA is coming in. So you literally got the feeling that the securities regulators in the United States were basically going through all the securities firms and saying, you know, no retail is going to have more than X percent of their accounts in precious metals. And that's a very chilling thing, because I proceeded after I moved, got all the accounts moved. I had the precious metal salesman from that firm try and call me to market precious metals to my clients. I said, are you aware your firm is kicking people out who have more than 20%? He was not aware of that fact. Anyway, what I'm saying is that if you look at the ability of G20 when they're sufficiently scared, I mean, they've got to be really scared. But when they're sufficiently scared and when they've got an agreement among themselves to do something like that, then I think you have quite a, you know, I think they have an ability to run the wholesale system at a different price level than the retail system for some period of time. Now, what that period of time is, I don't know. But I do think it's there. And certainly when it happens, it can knock all the speculators out of the market.
Well, but what you're, let me see if I'm interpreting correctly what you're saying. Namely, that they knew they had built up a huge short position in gold through their manipulations, and so they had to initiate a huge slapdown, whatever you want to call it, in gold, so that they could cover those, they could bring in gold and cover those positions. Is that, have I correctly interpreted?
Right, but it's part of a bigger realignment in the G20. So that's a piece of it, because they've got collateral problems across the board in essentially, you know, every market. And although, you know, who knows what's going on in the shadow banking business, sort of markets, because that market, from everything we can tell, as QE has been going on, has exploded again. So, you know, part of what's happening is we're struggling with less and less, you know, reliable statistics. And another one is, because you had brought up the Sterling Seagrave book on the different counts of gold and how much gold is in existence. You know, I've tried on several occasions to sit down and figure out what the global inventory of gold is globally, you know, and I've just finally thrown my hands up. And of course, reading Sterling Seagrave will do that to you. But, you know, I just said, look, it's very hard to get statistics that you can really believe in.
Right. I think James Turk told me about 150 tons world total. I don't know, you know, whether that's, or excuse me, 150,000 tons. But you read Barry Seagraves, and he's talking in terms of 125,000 or 110,000 tons that came out of the Japanese
Right. Not
what you call it, but I guess rape of East Asia. So how much? I don't know what the world total is, but whatever it is, it's not a lot. And considering that I think that they carried on a short for a long time, a manipulation of the price downward, and they did that by shorting gold and by building paper positions, then at some point, there ought to be a day of reckoning. So,
okay, so Franklin, why don't we turn to questions? We've got a couple of good questions.
Okay.
One is, let me just read it. I think former Solari interviewer Stuart Thompson is absolutely right about the precious metals market, specifically that Asia is what counts, and that the biggest event this year in the precious metals market was the Indian government's virtual ban on imports into India. I'm at the point where anyone saying anything about precious metals who doesn't mention Indian import restrictions goes on my don't listen to list. Please spend some time investigating this and recommending some sources for better tracking precious metals relevant political developments and macroeconomic developments affecting precious metals demand in Asia, especially India and China. I've always used Stuart and the Gadda Wire to do that. And I also read Stratfor, although they don't focus on gold. But I, other than those, I really don't know of any. Do you, Franklin?
Gata would be the the one I'd look at. But again, I think that it's a kind of a risky thing, placing too much emphasis on those flows into Asia. I mean, they're, every ounce of gold that's bought is sold by somebody else.
Right.
So I don't know what the significant, you know, the significance of those moves is. There'll be more significance when the price starts rising, certainly.
One of the things Stuart said in today's newsletter, which I thought was interesting, was he said, the growth of China and India's gold mine class is staggering. One Chinese state just announced an $80 billion robots program for 5,000 companies. Most of the world's university grads will soon be Indian. By 2030, India is projected to supply 1 out of 4 global university graduates.
Well, I think it's, you know, I mean, I think economically there's going to be rising income in those two places, and therefore you would assume there would be rising gold demand. But the fact that they're buying it this year, again, I'm saying, you know, you've got to distinguish between rising demand and simple flows from one side of the world to the other.
Right.
It's not exactly the same thing.
Another thing he points out is, let me just read it. There's another way to replace 70 tons a month of Indian demand, and gold stock analysts like Rick Rule are aware of it. If 80% of your current gold mining companies go bankrupt in 2014, then mine supply tanks and the gold price will soar. It was interesting. I was out at the Casey conference, and the different analyst projections of how many mining companies couldn't make it another year was pretty sobering, very sobering.
Right, because the gold price has gotten down to their break-even or below.
Oh, below.
Yeah.
For below. The other thing I wanted to mention, and I guess this is another difference between you and me and why I do think there are possibilities that it won't assert. I'm not saying this is definite. If you look at what is happening with new technology, I absolutely believe that if they decide to let that technology out of the lab, and I don't know how much they will. I can watch what they're letting out now. But if they continue to do this, you could literally see a crash up in the equity markets, and you could absolutely see tremendous deflationary pressures in the price of labor and in all sorts of global economics. It would be profoundly deflationary. And I think part of what we're watching in terms of the deflation is coming from technology. So I think if they move the technology line, you're going to see, you know, you could see very big changes in the economy. And to me, it's always been the wild card. And for many years, when people said, is there any scenario that you could see gold not continue up? You know, to me, that's the one, because technology so brings prices down and so, you know, it makes the debt manageable at some point, or certainly much more manageable than it is now. So we'll just have to see. Okay, let me go to the next question. Here's an assessment of gold by the Aiden sisters, who are consummate chartists. I would enjoy hearing you and Franklin comment on this assessment. I had sent that to you. Did you get a chance to take a look at it?
Yes. I did, and basically what they said that was that it is coming to a, you know, long-term buying point, is what they said.
Right.
But they weren't terribly precise in that piece about what that price was. And while I agree with them about the timing, I don't know what it, you know, when this is going to end. And in order for it to end, I have to see, I mean, you can look at a chart and say, well, this is coming to an end. This is not going to go on much longer. But the problem is, you, in order to say, okay, there's an end behind us, there's certain things I have to see, certain indicators or certain action in the price. And certainly one of those things is that gold and silver advance at least to the point where they broke out, and then past where they broke down, and then past that point. And so there are all these milestones in between there, here and there. There's 1320, there's 1360, there's 1434, there's, you know, above that there's 1500, there's, and then the big one is 1560, 1550, where the price broke down. And, you know, those are milestones that will add to our confidence as gold rallies. But we haven't passed those yet, and we don't have any other things, and we don't have any other indicators to show us that. Like, you know, in silver in 2008, you got a low at 880 about the 23rd of October, and then on the 11th of November, maybe it's the 8th of November anyway, you got a double bottom, 879 and 880. Okay, double bottom, good. Now, and then you get a strong advance off of that double bottom. And so you can look at that chart and say, well, it looks like it's going, looks like it's reversed and going up. And we haven't seen that. I haven't seen that yet. I told you little straws in the wind that I see in the chart today. You know, it's dancing, tap dancing around those, that 20, or that uptrend line. It's tap dancing around that shoulder line. But until we get away from that line, up and away from that line, that doesn't mean anything, you know. So
just explain, for those who don't understand, could you explain what a bottom is and how you prove a bottom?
Well, when you look at a chart, there's some formations that tell you that's a bottom. For instance, if the chart trades down into a V, if you can think of it just as a simple line, and it maybe it's easier. If it trades down into a V and then trades back up out of that V, then that's a pretty good sign of a bottom. If it makes an upside down head and shoulders, which is just take, you know, somebody's head and shoulder silhouette, turn it upside down, so you get a low, a lower low, and then a rise back up, a test of that first shoulder, and then it goes off above the neckline. That kind of thing, that's a very strong indication of a bottom. If you get a close above the 200-day moving average, and moving averages, you know, are just where you take the last, say, 20 days prices, and tomorrow you're going to drop the oldest price and pick up the newest one. So that makes a line that runs across the chart, and the longer the moving average, the slower slower the line moves. And if you've got a market that's trending up, then it's going to tend to be above its, say, 200-day moving average. If you've got a market that's in a bear market that's trending down, it's going to be below its 200-day moving average. Or that's bear market, bull market, or a bear phase in a bull market. But whenever, so we don't have the gold or silver above the 200-day moving average. I mean, neither one of them are. So, and the 200-day moving average is way up above the market now. So until we get those signs, you don't see a bottom. Another bottom is the kind of classic is a double bottom. Silver in 2008 went down to 879, and then about 3 weeks later it went to 880 and stopped and rallied up off of that 880. So when you see that, you know, well, we've got 2 feet on the ground. This is pretty firm. But again, you know, every day is a new day with markets. And unless it confirms, it continues to confirm, then and makes these progressive milestones, then you can't say that it's turned around.
Right.
So and there's another presupposition that's hiding behind that. A trend in force tends to remain in force until it's invalidated. And so if you've got a market that's trending down, it's going to keep on trending down until it invalidates that trend. And that, you know, you might draw a top, you might draw a line across those tops that descend across the chart, and when it gets up through that line, then it's invalidated the trend line. If it can get out above that and go a little, you know, a little beyond that. So that's the kind of thing that we're looking for. And when we see that, then we can say, yeah, okay, we've got a bottom here.
Okay, let me ask the next one. I currently own, and they describe an investment position in gold. actually gold and silver, with an average cost of this X. This Tuesday, November 12th, the price was down, so they're down about 30% on their position. If it turns out that the primary uptrend for gold and silver is over, historically, how long do bear markets of precious metals last? I do not need the cash, so I'm wondering, is it best to wait?
Well, you know, bear markets last 15 to 20 years. I'm not talking about bear phases. You know, people use the terms differently to the way I use them. When I say a bear market, I mean that 15 or 20 year primary trend. And so if I'm wrong, you ought to get out of gold and silver right now. If I'm wrong and the primary trend has turned into a bear trend or a downtrend, then you ought to get out of gold and silver right now, because there's no point in holding on. You know, this is like people in the stock market who says, well, you got to stay invested all the time. And then they point to specious statistics or comparisons from selected periods of time. Well, you can tell all kinds of lies with statistics. And the point is, the point of the primary trend is, it's the one thing that you must pay attention to and you must align your investments with. So if I thought gold and silver was in a primary downtrend, I'd sell everything I had at gold and silver right now.
See, now I wouldn't. That's funny, because I would sell everything I had in my investment position, but I wouldn't sell my coins that I had from my core position, because that's insurance.
Well, so you made a good point about that in your you published an article a few days ago, and I agree with you about that point. But when you talk about investment, you know, about a insurance position, I guess you'd call that, you're talking about small gold that you keep yourself, where you can get, where you have access to it 24 hours a day. And right. if you ever need it, you can get it and go with it. And let me tell you two stories, okay? I had this doctor in the early 80s. He was an Austrian, and he was an Austrian Jew, and he was a customer. He would come buy gold. And we talked, and he said, well, you know, I was a child in the 1930s, and we lived in Austria. And my father said, oh, the Nazis will never come here. We don't have to worry about that. But I had this uncle who kept putting money in gold in Switzerland. And so when the Anschluss came, we had to leave after the Anschluss. And we went to Switzerland. And the only thing we had to start over on was that gold that my uncle had saved. And then I had another customer who was a Hungarian. And after World War II, he and his father, right at the end of World War II, went back to their house into the basement where his father had buried some gold coins. And he said, when he was 12 years old, he said, when I heard his shovel hit that lockbox with those gold coins in it, I knew we'd survive.
Right.
So, you know, when you hear enough stories like that, then you understand what we're talking about is bottom line insurance, survival kind of thing.
Right, right.
And I certainly would have that position.
So you wouldn't sell your core.
No. But no. I mean, I wouldn't keep a very big core position if I thought that the market was in a bear market. I mean, I thought gold and silver in a bear market.
Well, so my feeling is, you know, if gold could go down, you had said, you know, I would say 1,100. If gold could, in a consolidation, go down to 1,100, to me, if you're in an investment position, you can ride it down and not sell until it breaks. And if it breaks below that, you can sell. Or you can just say, you know, I'm selling now, and then it'll prove a bottom or it won't. And when it proves a bottom, I just buy back in.
Right.
Why not
do
that?
But none of that stuff is without cost. That's the thing. I mean, you know, you've got transaction costs, first of all, and then if I got out now, I mean, let's just look at today, okay? Let's say I sold out everything at $1,285. When would I get back in? I would not get back in until gold got over, you know, $1,550. So there's a big cost. There's a big risk there that when you get out, you end up having to pay a whole lot to get your position back, which is the very reason that I don't recommend trading in and out for most people. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, I mean, there's
I would rather, I'm the kind of person I would get out. I wouldn't be ready to ride it all the way down to the bottom necessarily, but I would, you know, I'd be willing to take some risk and get in before 1560. But I think, you know, it really comes down to what's your appetite to ride it down that far and what's your appetite not to. So, and that's a very personal decision.
Yeah, but there are two things that weigh on this to me. One is there's a great book by a fellow named Lefebvre called Confessions of a Stock Market Operator. And I recommend everybody who's thinking about investing, buy that book and read it. And this probably Jesse Livermore who wrote the book, and Lefebvre was the fellow who he dictated it to. But anyway, he was a great stock market operator in the early part of the 20th century, all the way into the 20s. And one of the things that he goes into huge detail about is not selling out a bull market position. Not selling out a bull market position. And he has a great section in there about that. And that's really stuck with me. The other thing that would prevent my selling out is you always have to ask your question, if I sell out, what am I going into? And I don't know what that is. I really do not trust the stock market now because it's a market that's risen on new money, not, in my considered opinion,
only North America. So North America's up, say, 25% for the year.
Yeah.
But the emerging markets are down.
Right.
So
Japan is up through the same kind of manipulation. The Japanese market is up over a year ago from the same sort of monetary manipulation. So I look around and I can't see anything else I have to go into. And then I'm basically a fundamentalist in the sense, you know, I mean, there are people who are fundamental investors and there are people who are technical investors. I don't mean I'm a Muslim fundamentalist, for heaven's sakes. But anyway,
right. The
people who look at fundamentals and fundamentals really count with me because that's what drives markets. Those are the forces that are very, very powerful that drive markets. And the fundamental monetary factors are all in gold and silver's favor. And the last 5 years have just proven that in spades. And I really believe, Catherine, I'll just say this to make people feel better. I think that entire system, the imperial system that you talk about, the parasitical system, the tapeworm economy, I think that we're witnessing the death of that system now. It's not going to go fast. Once it gets started, it may, but it's a long, slow process, and it can maybe kill you in the process. But the monetary forces that they've turned loose are eventually going to blow up in their faces. And for that reason, I think what we have to do is to think, how am I going to take value? How am I going to take capital across all of this turmoil? And the only answer I come up with is silver and gold. That's another reason I want to stay in silver and gold because I don't.
So
think
I'll play devil's advocate because I haven't been buying gold and silver. I've been buying emerging market stocks.
Yeah.
And you know, if you look at these companies and who they are and what they're doing,
You know me.
I love enterprises. I love great teams of people. I love family businesses. I love, you know, and it's all the stuff I love. And I think globally, there is an explosion of people creating companies. So the opportunities, if you're an American, the opportunities to invest in enterprises around the world is increasing every day. And they're great companies, you know, and they're solving the problems of the world. So, you know, or they're doing something very, very useful. So I see a lot of opportunity there. And, you know, but
I'm not saying there is not opportunity, but
right.
I certainly would say this. I would say that those opportunities cannot be realized until the present system is out of the way. It doesn't mean they cannot be realized in part. It does not mean that they cannot be realized on a limited scale. But to really, it's just like the United States. I mean, there's a huge amount of economic ability and prosperity pinned up here because of government regulation and government standing in the way. And until they get out of the way, nothing's going to happen. You know, I mean, the frustration of that is extremely bitter to me. I'm with you. I'd rather be, you know, it's a lot more exciting.
I don't disagree that the boot isn't significant. The boot is very significant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what amazes me is to see what companies have accomplished despite it. So, you know, it's almost like there are two forces, one that's building positive and one that's trying to harvest and ride it. And there's kind of a war. It's almost a spiritual war between the two. And it's ongoing. So, you know, I hope I hope the builders win.
I do too. You know, I mean, because I love producers. I was kidding my brother-in-law the other day. You know, I mean, he gets all upset about these things going on in the government, and I don't blame him. But I said, look, you know what? Your problem is you're a producer, and you don't get it. Because if I put you down on a desert island, in a week and a half, you'd have coconuts stacked up. You'd be, you know, making a palm log cabin. Because you do that stuff naturally. You're a producer. That's the kind of person you are. And you know, just like you're made in the image of God, you got to create. That's what you have to do. And the part you don't get is that these other people are parasites. They destroy. That's what they do. They destroy. And right now, the people who are the parasites are the ones who control the government.
But here's the thing. I don't quite understand why they're doing what they're doing. You know, I've spent my whole life trying to understand who they are and why they're doing what they're doing. And it's not 100% clear to me. You know, I think the story is more complicated than you might think. So I'm just saying we don't know. And I like to sit in somebody's shoes before I judge them completely.
Well,
so.
I see so much evil, though. I mean, just like you said earlier tonight.
Yeah.
This is we live in an economy that's based on war, that's based on killing people.
Well, it's more than that. It's based on turning them into zombies and then harvest, you know, using them as slaves.
Right.
So
I can't see, you know, I can sit in their shoes all week, and I won't be able to see what's good about that. And that's that's basically what's been created over the last 100-150 years. So I'm hoping that's coming to an end. But
Well, just one last thought on the question. You know, I pulled up a chart and looked at the chart year to date, and the S&P is up 25%. Gold, using GLD, is down about 23-25%, and then the miners are down about 50%. And what that means is if you started the beginning of the year with a dollar and you were in the S&P, you have $1.25. If you were in gold, you've got about 75 cents. And if you were in the miners, you were got about 50 cents.
Right.
And that's what I mean about not riding something down. Because, you know, if you stayed in the miners, now you've got to get, you know, a 200% increase just to get back to where you could have been if you'd been in equities. Now, that's North American equities, again, because the emerging markets have not looked like that at all. And commodities are worse if you look at coffee. I don't know if you've looked at a coffee chart recently. I put up on the blog, Starbucks' stock is up 40%, and the price of coffee is down 40%. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so that, you know, those are the pros and cons of getting out and getting in, and I think it's a personal issue for everybody, and part of it depends on how much you've got. You know, if you've got 90% Franklin, it looks very different than if you've got 20%.
Right. There's a greater level of pay.
Okay, so there are two other things I wanted to cover before we end today, which are not precious metals. Anything else on precious metals before we – what should we look for in the next month? What would you be watching for? What are you going to be watching for?
Well, literally in the next few days, whether that green line is broken, that uptrend line, and if that's broken, then I expect you're going to see, you know, considerably lower prices. and we will get a low either, you know, some low that will make a double bottom with that June low. And that might be higher, it might be the same, it might be lower. So that's what you've got to look for. And then on the upside, you have to look for really a close above 1360 and then a close above 1434. And
okay.
You know, there's no we've had too many failed attempts to get through there. You just have to get through those levels to prove that we're rising again.
Right, but this is the time of year which should be good. So,
well, it ought to be, you know, and oftentimes you see, as I said, a low in November, and usually not a low in December.
So let me ask you, if the primary trend does not reassert before spring,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we hit spring, that's the time that we go into the time of year, which is generally not the best for precious metals. You know, if the primary trend doesn't reassert by the spring, what does that mean? Is there a certain time frame you're looking for?
Well, you know, I've been studying tops in the lows and highs in the gold and silver markets, and actually a lot of highs occur before the first half of May. So generally that first part of the year, even though you get lows in January maybe, you get a lot of highs in May, and actually before the first or the middle of May. But it depends on whether you're going up or going down when you go in.
Right.
Whether the market's rising or falling when you go into the year. And so if you've had a peak and in December and you go down into January, but you know, I would think by next year, see here, one of the things that I watch is the interest rate, because part of the key, the keystone to the Fed's policy is to keep that interest rate low. And the interest rate rising will be a sign that they've lost control or they're in the process of losing control. You have to realize that the bond market broke earlier this year, and it rose into July or August, and then the bonds started going back up, but recently they jumped again. So, you know, if that interest rate right now it's about 2.7 on the 10-year bond, if that interest rate goes up, the Fed has trouble. And I think that will be probably the first sign that trouble is about to hit, is that, you know, is that interest rate rising. So I look at the rate every day. I mean, it doesn't always do very much, but I think it's worth looking at every day.
Now, traditionally, interest rates rising has been bad for precious metals.
Well,
hasn't it?
Not really. I mean, the higher the long-term rates are, the better it is for gold. But it's very
right.
difficult. If you look at inflation, high interest rates and inflation just indicate high inflation. They don't really necessarily indicate high interest rates, if you follow what I'm saying. And so
right.
at the peak, it took interest rates of 24% to wring the inflation out of the economy back in 1980. And that was after gold had, you know, gold had already peaked. But, you have to look at the real interest rate and say high real interest rates, especially high long-term real interest rates, not high short-term interest rates, are
right.
good for gold.
Right. Okay, so let's switch. You have your new book ready. You want to tell us about it?
At Home in Dogwood Meadow, Volume 2. And it is, I have to tell you, it's even way funnier than the first volume and way more fun. And it's just, I thought it was going to be here early in December, but they actually, the printer actually got them done and got them back to us just day, actually yesterday. They came in yesterday. Uh-huh. And so I'm really excited about it. It just carries forward with our you know, our adventures in learning to live in the country and learning to live on a farm. And
well, I love the first one. I haven't read the second one. I've ordered it, so I should get it as soon as I get back to Tennessee.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's going to be a lot of fun. And we've got a lot more, we've actually got a lot of pictures in this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
So, anyway, you'll get to see the actors, although some of them have four legs and some of them have
okay, then you also have done a webinar on local economies, which is now available. It's recorded and available. We'll have the link up at the blog.
Right. Jason Mattias, who is the director of a documentary they're filming now and putting together now called Beyond Off the Grid, asked me to do a webinar about rebuilding local economies. So we talked about that quite a bit. And it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Go ahead.
I was just talking with someone about the squeeze on the farmers,
uh-huh,
between farmers markets requiring insurance from the farmers and the insurance companies then denying the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So basically cutting them off from building retail markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to this person, what's the best state where we could get the state involved and see if we couldn't make changes so that this wouldn't be happening? And he said, probably Tennessee. I thought, oh, wait till I tell Franklin this. I once had I'm on this list of luminaries of the financial blogospheres, and I once had one guy screaming about derivatives, and I came up about the chicken processing issue that you were lobbying for,
mm-hmm,
and he came back at me and said, you know, this is typical, you have your head in the sand, you can't see the big issues. And I said, no, listen, you know, let me tell you something. If everybody can just create a business, you know, growing their own food, then, you know, then we can't get owned by this derivatives game. Finally, it took about 5 emails, but I finally got the derivatives folks to agree that chicken processing was very important. And there was a relationship between the two.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there is. Very much so. Yeah.
Anyway, so I, you know, to me, to rebuild the local economy,
mm-hmm,
you've got to rebuild your small farms. And
that's where it all starts. That's the bottom. That's the foundation. And they're doing everything they can to suppress those small farms. And, you know, it's just like, it's analogous to what they're doing to every small business. They just,
right,
want to squeeze them out of existence. And the reason for that, of course, is that they don't want the big companies that control the regulators don't want the competition.
Right. So. Right. Every penny is another penny they can put into the stock market. I'm absolutely serious.
Every penny is another penny to buy glyphosate and Roundup with.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Franklin, it's been great being with you. We'll see you as soon as I get back to Tennessee, hopefully, or when I get back to Tennessee. And we look forward to being back with you in January. And let's just hope we have a strong season for precious metals until then, okay?
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.